Hi, my name is Kunal, and welcome to the Geeks of the Valley podcast, which connects with some of the brightest minds globally who are leading their respective industries today to discuss the hottest upcoming industry trends and how their work is affecting the global economy. What started off as a coffee chat has now grown into a global platform for visionaries.
This morning from Ibiza, please give a warm welcome to Matthew King, an entrepreneurial investor with a passion for shaping the future. As the co-founder and managing partner at Valhalla Ventures, Matthew leads a team of visionary investors dedicated to supporting trailblazing founders at the forefront of social and technological breakthroughs. Matthew's unique ability to connect extraordinary individuals for seeking out the extraordinary make him a true connoisseur of innovation. He thrives on helping founders achieve legendary outcomes while delivering exceptional returns and making a positive impact. Valhalla Ventures is actively shaping the future in their current areas of focus, deep tech, including AI, advanced materials and manufacturing, synthetic biology, as well as defense and aerospace. Get ready to embark on an inspiring journey as we dive deep into the minds of extraordinary individuals like Matthew King. Matthew, thank you so much for joining us this morning from Ibiza.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure to join. Thank you guys for having me. It's great to be on, Kunal.
And how are things with you over there?
You know, things are, given the state of the world right now, can't complain. I have been connecting here with a number of our investors. We actually have a pretty sizable enclave of Valhalla Limited partners that live here in Ibiza. And so it's been wonderful reconnecting with them. It's been about a year since I was on the island. And also got to spend some time with one of our portfolio company founders out here, who is actually out here for a conference in Barcelona. And I convinced him to pop over to Ibiza for a quick trip and actually raise some money out of it. So it was a productive trip.
Yeah, when you think about venture capital investors and entrepreneurs and founders, you don't really think Ibiza as one of the first places.
You know, it's actually interesting, and you know, everybody has an opinion in the, you know, work from home versus back to office debate. And you know, I have been a pretty committed digital nomad for the past few years. I actually have only spent about, I would say, 9 months or a year or so in the United States in the last 3 years since the pandemic or so. And actually have found some of our biggest investors, as well as our biggest investments, through this kind of wanderlust. And I can get into that more a bit later. But, you know, one of our largest single investors is based here in Ibiza, a gentleman who's written about $5 or $6 million worth of checks for us. And then also sourced one of our biggest investments, Bugatti Rimac, from a trip to Croatia during the pandemic. So it's I think it's important to be in motion as a venture investor. It is always exposing me to new ideas, new people, and also just fun.
Let's jump into the first question here, shall we, Matt?
Sounds great.
Can you share a bit about your background and how you got involved into the venture capital industry?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I can remember since being younger, even in elementary school, I had an interest in investments. And then, you know, I kind of followed my parents' guidance, which was, you know, climb the corporate ladder, and that's the path to success in America. And so I, you know, went to prestigious college, started working in startups and solar energy to begin with. And then I went back to business school, and in business school, I determined, you know, instead of rather than being in a sales role, which is what I was doing after college, I wanted to be on the investor side of the table. I had a notion that that was where I could make more impact, make more money, et cetera. And so in business school, I did a short stint in investment banking at Morgan Stanley in their technology investment banking group. I got to work with some incredible companies there. I was working out of the Menlo Park office, which is the office that, you know, did many marquee transactions, you know, led the Google IPO, led the Facebook IPO, the WhatsApp Facebook transaction, et cetera. I didn't work on those deals, to be clear, but got exposure to companies and got to work for companies like Amazon, IBM, First Solar, Bloom Energy, Fitbit, and a number of others. So that's kind of where I learned capital markets, you know, raising capital for companies, M&A, et cetera. And then from there, after graduating from business school, I ended up going to Microsoft, and I spent a couple years at Microsoft doing enterprise software sales. I was staffed on a very difficult product to sell, which was Dynamics 365. I competed with Salesforce and a number of other CRM providers, but it was a great learning experience, and also, cemented in my mind that I didn't really want to work in corporate. I explained the experience of working at Microsoft to folks as being a microcosm of the company's logo. It's like being a square within a bigger square. It really kind of felt like being a cog in a machine. And so, I knew that I wanted to do something else. It was early 2017 when I left Microsoft and determined to do more or less a complete 180. I actually asked myself, what would be the complete opposite of the experience of going into the office at Microsoft every day? And it was around that time that a friend called me and said, "Hey, I've got a, this is 2017, so right after Prop 64 passed in California, which legalized adult use of cannabis. I have been a lifelong aficionado of cannabis products since the age of about 14. Growing up in Northern California was kind of part of the culture. And so when my friend called me and said, "Hey, I've got a buddy in Humboldt that has a large scale cannabis farm and they need help raising capital. I know you're connected with a bunch of investor types. Would you mind connecting with him?" I said, "Sure." And so I ended up going to Humboldt County for what I thought was going to be a weekend. Ended up staying almost 6 months on and off, and really, it was a trial by fire in the cannabis industry. Got to, tour pretty much every farm that would let me on their property, experiment and sample a lot of the product, but also, developed a really strong reputation for helping founders. Ended up raising almost $30 million for a handful of different companies. And that was actually where I had my first success and my big unicorn that I hitched a ride on. So there was a company called Harvest Health that was a multi-state operator, started out of Arizona and then went coast to coast. And that company was raising a Series A at the time. This was 2018. I connected them with a Canadian merchant bank that ended up writing a check for the entire $10 million Series A. That Canadian merchant bank went on to raise an additional few hundred million dollars and put together some big M&A transactions that resulted in the company going public at $1.5 billion valuation within 12 months of the A round. So that was, the first time I saw that much value get created in that short amount of time. And I thought, wow, this beats the shit out of the 9 to 5. So that was where I was hooked. I kept kind of chasing all of these off the beaten path industry verticals that were being overlooked and had historically been completely ignored basically by traditional tier one investment firms, and then investment banks. And so those included, first I saw the alpha shifting from cannabis over to the psychedelic therapeutic space. So I started looking at psychedelics companies. I had a passion for blockchain technology and did a short stint as head of business development for a blockchain technology company. So there was a period where I was looking at a lot of blockchain related investments. And then there was a gaming company, or I should say gaming companies that I started looking at. And it was actually through a gaming company investment into a company called FaZe Clan that I met my current business partner, David Malhotra. And that was really the start of Valhalla. That was about 3 years ago. And from there, we had very complementary networks that allowed us to basically effectively capitalize the deals that we were both seeing. And so it became, started off as a friendship and then became a working relationship. And then that served as the foundation for building Valhalla. And that's how we got here today.
And to dive a bit deeper, could you highlight some very specific deals that Valhalla has invested in and discuss the investment thesis behind those deals?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll give a couple of examples reflecting our current investment focus areas. So our current investment focus areas are deep tech and gaming, and I'll give one from each. In deep tech, one of our most recent investments is a company based out of Austin called Group One. Group One was started by the founder of Advano, which is a next generation silicon company in the battery space that's raised over $40 million to date. Group One is working on commercializing a novel potassium cathode material spun out of the legendary Professor John Goodenough's lab at UT Austin. The great characteristic of potassium, as opposed to lithium, is that it's super abundant all over North America. and its adoption would mean a much more resilient supply chain for all kinds of batteries, not to mention significant cost benefits over lithium. Early data has shown that the performance is on par or better than LFP, the lithium iron phosphate batteries that are increasingly dominant and come out of most of the production there is monopolized by Chinese manufacturers. What we really liked about Group One was that they're focusing on developing and producing just the cathode alone, rather than trying to become a full stack battery manufacturer, which we think is a mistake that a lot of battery startups have made in the past. So that's one just on the deep tech side. I'll give one on the gaming side as well. So one of our investments is a company called 1v1me. It's a New York-based company facilitating head-to-head matches between video game streamers, which enables their fans to predict the outcome. So 1v1v uses the concept of poker staking, in which rather than putting a bet on, rather than placing a traditional bet, fans are effectively giving money to the player that they support and think is going to win, and then they earn a share of that player's prize pot if they win. So the great thing about staking is that it's actually legal in almost every jurisdiction globally. So it enables competitive gaming to become a truly worldwide phenomenon. And 1v1me also completely scraps the traditional esports model by acknowledging that most of the value lies in the player's personal brand, so in the streamers, rather than in arbitrary teams and leagues. And then that way, streamers don't just get views because they're good at the game and can win matches, but more importantly, because they're entertaining and can actually effectively engage their audience. That's just to give a couple of examples on our recent investments.
And one of your most interesting focuses seems to be Turan Biosciences. Can you tell us more about their program and why your fund has made the biggest bet on them?
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned Turan Biosciences. So that's actually the founder that I mentioned prior, who had been visiting me in Ibiza. It's Dr. Samuel Clark. And he'd actually been out here in Barcelona for the European College of Neuropsychopharmacology conference. And so I convinced him to come over here. So I just got to spend a week with him out here, and we had a blast. And the reason that we made, I'll give some context on the investment, but it's one of two investments that Valhalla has made in the life sciences space. And it came about through our thesis in the very early days of our investment practice around broader mental health crisis. So I've had a longstanding personal interest in the application of psychedelic-assisted therapy for treating mental health conditions. And it was around 2018, when I was deep in financing cannabis companies, that I observed that psychedelics, including magic mushrooms, MDMA, LSD, ayahuasca, and others, were likely going to follow a similar path of decriminalization, acceptance by both medical community and patients, and that it would most likely become a mainstream treatment within our lifetimes. So we began meeting with companies in the psychedelic space, many of which are now publicly traded companies. I'd estimate that we talked to, I would say, about 4 or 5 dozen companies in the space, and we noticed similar patterns across all of the pitches. All of the management teams seem to be vying for intellectual property around classical psychedelic compounds, namely psilocybin, DMT, LSD, and MDMA. However, all of the management teams that we spoke with, very few were founded by individuals possessing strong scientific credentials, and almost none had experience in traditional biopharma. So it was shortly after announcing our firm's inaugural investment into atai Life Sciences on LinkedIn that I got a DM from Dustin Tetzel, who's Terran's chief business officer. And Dustin was an old friend of mine from almost 2 decades ago through mutual friends in the Harvard and Columbia communities. And he told me that he just left his role as the first non-founder hire at Roivant Sciences, where he helped grow the company through its $7 billion IPO and managed the sale of a portfolio of their drugs to Sumitomo, a Japanese conglomerate, for $3 billion. And that in his new role at Terran Biosciences, they were beginning to develop some novel IP in the psychedelic space. I told him I was intrigued to learn more and wanted to hop on a call with the company's founder, Sam Clark. And it was in the middle of the COVID lockdowns that I was perched on a balcony overlooking Barcelona when the call began. And I distinctly remember within the first minute of conversation that I was certain that Sam was the most knowledgeable person I'd spoken with, both on the science and business sides of commercializing psychedelic compounds to treat mental health disorders. Importantly, while we were deeply intrigued by Terran's work in the psychedelic space, What really led to Valhalla making such an outsized bet was the fact that the company's primary focus was on developing a suite of other, more traditional biopharma assets, including compounds such as idazoxin, which is an adjunctive therapy for schizophrenia that can essentially double the baseline efficacy of all other antipsychotic drugs. And then they also had a software division that was developing an AI diagnostic tool, which is capable of detecting Parkinson's and other neurodegenerative diseases by reading a biomarker in the brain called neuromelanin, and using essentially a traditional MRI scan. So we essentially, at the early stages when we invested at Series A, we essentially attributed almost no value to Terran's psychedelics program, and that was, largely given just how nascent it was. They basically pitched us an idea, which they ended up executing on, and we ended up ascribing almost all of the value of their company to the core drug development platform and the software platforms that they were developing for treating and diagnosing a wide variety of mental health issues as well as neurodegenerative diseases. So to date, we have invested heavily into Terran across Series A and B. I'll say it's in the tens of millions. And we are, to my knowledge, the single largest outside shareholder. It's been really terrific seeing how the team's executed over the past few years since we invested, and not only hitting their initially proposed milestones, but they've actually exceeded pretty much every milestone that they had set, and given us some new juicy tidbits about what they're working on. There are a number of upcoming milestones, including multiple clinical trials for both the schizophrenia and psychedelics programs, as well as the imminent commercialization of their AI diagnostic tool, which we believe will serve as valuation catalysts that will bring Terran hopefully into unicorn status.
And it seems deep tech is an emerging field with great potential. How does your fund approach deep tech investments, especially when it comes to the factors you consider when evaluating such opportunities?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's also pretty topical given that, a number of VCs seem to be pivoting to deep tech. We've seen it in the market, and we've also heard it from LPs. I think people are kind of starting to realize that there's a lot of opportunity in deep tech, and after success of companies like SpaceX and others, there's just a lot of interest in people chasing everything from space tech, defense tech, et cetera. So, I'm happy to provide some more color on how we determined that we wanted to go into this space. Really, it comes down to the fact that we believe that physical technology, so hardware, is actually where most of the value is going to accrue over the next few decades. Previously, VC was really focused on SaaS, and software had dominated the last couple decades of VC returns. I think that's primarily driven by the, that's just where the money was, and people were chasing where the money was. What I think is happening right now, particularly with the development of AI and large language models and the, pretty significant debasement in the cost of developing code, is that the cycles in software have shortened to the point where it's basically impossible to imagine that pure play software companies will become cash flow positive. And it's because, they are going to have to constantly spend on new product development. By the time most companies ship a product, they're probably going to be 10 or more identical or, marginally varied competitors in the works. And so in that kind of a competitive landscape, margins, it becomes commoditized and margins essentially trend towards zero. So that was our thesis for kind of, not focusing on software investments. Whereas with hard technology, so hardware, it's really difficult to make. And so there are not many companies that have top engineering talent that can build a wide moat. And disruption cycles are long, and the talent required to do these hard engineering projects is quite scarce. So by the time somebody that can develop a good hardware product, it's basically they have a first mover advantage. And so most of the good companies that have a good product and can get it to market are going to be well on their way to monopolizing that market. And, going to Peter Thiel's 0 to 1, we believe that oftentimes markets are winner take all, if or winner take most. And so you want to bet on the first mover there. And we think that that's still possible to do in hardware, whereas in software, that's going to get increasingly difficult. And on that, we see at the early stage there are two things that are really important for deep tech companies besides needing exceptional technical founders. Those two things are first, the ability to recruit really talented engineers out of companies, for example, SpaceX, which is, a couple of the recent space tech companies that we've invested in have been, engineers that are leaving SpaceX. And then the second thing is the ability to raise capital cheaply. And so without top-tier engineers that can question assumptions and really innovate, it's very difficult to build any kind of a manufacturing or hardware product without just burning cash. So even with the best engineers, building hard tech isn't cheap, and it requires founders to go out and convince large capital sources to put up, anywhere from $50 million to $100 million before recognizing a dime of revenue. So again, that plays to the good founders of hardware companies that are able to go out and raise capital are going to have a good opportunity to capture market share before competitors are able to crop up and reduce margins.
Most recently we see that you've kind of invested in several kind of gaming companies, one being founded by one of the creative directors of League of Legends, right? And can you tell us more about your investments in the gaming industry and the unique aspects of the IP-based vertical which you focus on?
Yeah, absolutely. So within gaming, we're really only looking at two key themes. So the first theme that we're looking at is capital efficient IP. I think, historically, gaming IP has been pretty lucrative, and people tend to, when they think of, gaming investments that worked out well, they think of like, a Rockstar Games or Epic Games, etc. And, I think the trouble with that is that backing AAA studios is extremely capital intensive and it's hits driven. It's kind of like investing in movies. There are all kinds of producers that would finance movies in Hollywood, but you have really kind of idiosyncratic risk on a deal by deal basis of failure. You can invest $100 million into a AAA video game or a movie and have it completely, essentially not find product market fit, basically, not be a success on debut. And so the thing that we're looking for is to focus on overlooked or even entirely novel forms of IP generation. And so in the former category, we have made investments across mobile and tabletop games, which is the one that you were mentioning, Incredible Dream Studios, founded by Jane Hoffacker. She was formerly the creative director at League of Legends, and she basically said, look, it's going to be really expensive to go out and do a video game company and raise, $50 to $100 million and hope that the title succeeds. And so she said, well, instead of doing that, what if we raise just, a small seed round, and with just $1 million, you can develop an IP for a board game. And then you can go and do a Kickstarter campaign and get pre-sales for that board game to test product market fit and see whether or not people actually whether or not that IP actually resonates with consumers. So that's essentially what she did. She raised, a small seed round, and now she has essentially a few shots on goal where she can develop, very cheaply intellectual property for tabletop board games. If you look at Hasbro, which owns the Wizards of the Coast, which is generates about $7 billion out of an $11 billion market cap. Wizards of the Coast owns, Dungeons and Dragons and other gaming IPs. And so we thought this was a really interesting and innovative approach to a, pretty outdated business. So that was the logic behind our investment in Incredible Dream Studio. Then we're also looking at other kind of interesting and more novel kinds of web-based and narrative storytelling. And so we're looking right now into virtual reality content after the launch of Apple's Vision Pro. And so, yeah, we see that fueling some more developer activity in that space as well. So looking at some pitches there. The other area that we're investing in gaming is social and competition platforms. And this goes back to 1v1me, which I mentioned earlier. So even though gaming is one of the largest global markets by user count, there are about 2 billion gamers globally, nobody has really cracked the code on social gamers, particularly for mobile. So Discord has never really generated meaningful revenue, and Twitch is really more of a content consumption platform rather than a social platform. So we're actively seeking out super engaging social platforms and real money competition platforms that we think can attract meaningful user bases and create a really meaningful social layer for people to connect.
So Matt, I know you alluded to this earlier in the call, but you know, what I'd like to hear is what sets Valhalla apart from other venture capital funds, particularly in terms of the LP base of senior executives, C-suites, CXOs at large corporations, and so on.
Yeah, absolutely. Now I think there are some key differentiators for Valhalla. I think, there are a lot of extraordinary VC funds that we share cap tables with, and we hold those VC funds in really high esteem. I'd say my personal observation is that most founders have a pretty common experience of working with VCs, where VCs will sell them the world in terms of the help that they can offer. Everything from, hiring key executives to bringing in capital for future financings, et cetera, et cetera. But really few of those VCs actually deliver. And so, in my opinion, while having a, great network of C-suites and board executives, celebrities, all of that, it's basically table stakes for being in the consideration as a top-tier VC fund today. I'd say what really differentiates VCs for founders is what they actually do. And most, frankly, don't really do that much. So, time and time again, we've heard from founders that even some of the biggest names in the industry, they sell themselves on their value add, and then they basically write a check and then do really almost nothing after that. So, what we really pride ourselves on at Valhalla is differentiating on action. Our name actually is taken from the mythological Viking heaven, which is where Odin's chosen warriors are reborn to fight in Ragnarok, which is the battle of the end times. And so when we were naming the firm, we really wanted to go with something that was legendary and mythological in proportion and, was inspiring of, what we feel entrepreneurship is essentially like being in battle or war. And so, we really believe in our role as VCs is to support people through the most difficult battle of their lives and build companies into huge successes. So our commitment to founders is that Valhalla will work tirelessly to build value in their businesses. You can reference us pretty extensively and hear directly from founders of our portcos that in many cases, we may be a relatively small, and in some cases, even the smallest investor in terms of ownership on a company's cap table, but the founders will tell you that we've delivered disproportionate business value. So there are a few companies, in fact, that I think the founders will tell you that Valhalla has been basically either the number one or number two highest value add investors on their cap table. And in those companies, we're actually probably the smallest check on the cap table. And so that's really kind of our aspiration and our commitment to the founders that we back. When we get conviction in a founder, we will move heaven and earth in order to assure their success. And that means, everything from going out and finding key executive hires. We placed probably close to a dozen, maybe even two dozen key executive hires across our portfolio companies at this point. We've helped with raising tens of millions of dollars in follow-on capital for our portfolio companies. And then, we've brought some key celebrities to cap tables, everybody from Drake to Jay-Z and Roc Nation to CAA, really kind of the cream of the crop. And so, I think for a lot of firms now, it's kind of, everybody pitches themselves on having, these unique relationships and, having a relationship with XYZ executive or whatever. But it's really not many of them that put everything together and combine the great networks that they have with actually being action oriented and, being up at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning writing emails and, grinding out an M&A transaction or et cetera in order to get companies to liquidity events. So that I think is where we've differentiated and I'm confident that our references will check out on that one.
So Matt, looking ahead, where do you see the future of the venture capital industry heading? Are there any trends or developments that you believe will significantly shape the industry in the coming years?
So I think going forward, this is going to play out in two ways. The first is that there are going to be a lot of funds that just won't generate returns and won't be able to raise follow-on funds, and therefore are just going to become defunct. I think this is pretty much going to be the fate for most of the growth-oriented funds that were formed in the last like 3 to 5 years and basically got into, not such great companies at really high valuations. And they're now sitting on paper, a lot of them, that's been written down as much as 80 to 90%. So think about, a lot of crypto funds, et cetera. A lot of people were just kind of chasing the dragon and hoping that these companies would be able to IPO and then trade out. And that trade is now completely unwound. So I think first you're going to see just a significant wave of failures of VC funds. The second piece, I think, is that there's going to be an increasing amount of consolidation. So a lot of the top decile funds with multiple billions in assets under management have essentially become asset management firms. These firms basically have multiple investment platforms spanning early stage growth. Now some of them are doing even public equities and wealth management. I think these funds are going to continually be looking for an edge in the market and look for new products that they can sell to their LPs. And as a result, we're seeing partnerships and even outright M&A between some of these larger funds and then relative upstarts that have a strong sector stage focus. I think one example that comes to mind just recently in the past week, so General Catalyst just announced their acquisition of a Berlin-based seed fund called La Famiglia. La Famiglia is a long-standing seed-focused fund, and they've been early in a number of Europe's top startups and unicorns. And so through their acquisition, General Catalyst essentially gains a foothold in a geography and stage focus that otherwise it would have taken them considerable amount of time and resources to garner. So my guess is that we're going to see an uptick in the number of these large tier one VC funds that, again, are essentially asset management firms at this point, and they're going to be acquiring their way into deal flow or otherwise partnering with leading accelerators and seed funds in order to basically get a pipeline of deals for their much larger growth-oriented funds.
So, taking a slight turn here, how do you perceive, especially now, the political and global trends impacting the venture capital space in the long term? Are there any specific factors that you believe will have a significant influence on investment decisions and strategies as VCs look ahead?
Yeah, for sure. So, in our view, the current geopolitical landscape was a major driver of Valhalla's decision to push into deep tech investments. So we're living in a really interesting time where simultaneously individuals' faith in institutions is at an all-time low, while the influence of those institutions in our lives is ever increasing. So I don't know many VCs that invest based on a 5 or 10 year model of the macroeconomy, or really anyone that invests based on anticipated geopolitical events, but I definitely know a lot of VCs that look at secular trends in order to develop their investment thesis. So our investment thesis around deep tech is based on the secular trend of rising geopolitical tensions between the West and the East, and that's driving both a figurative as well as a literal arms race across space tech, chip manufacturing, advanced weapon systems, advanced materials, advanced manufacturing, synthetic biology, and so on and so on. So in the coming decades, we believe that it's very likely that there will be vast sums of non-dilutive financing available for companies that have breakthrough technologies that give nation states either strategic defense capabilities or some kind of a broader technological superiority, particularly in the realms of, for example, energy, compute, and manufacturing. And then we've seen this play out in the recent history of venture investments. Everywhere from the early DOE grants that Tesla won, all the way through to the recent $1 billion contract that Anduril won from SOCOM in order to develop counter drone tech. So, given the steady increase in geopolitical conflicts, which, just the events of the past week or two here are strongly reinforcing this, that there is going to be a steady increase in geopolitical conflict and tension, particularly between the East and the West, namely the US and China. And as a result of that, we see a significant increase in government spending on key technologies that will result from that.
And speaking of like key technologies, what are your thoughts on investing in emerging markets? Do you see these markets as attractive opportunities for venture capital? And if so, what are some key considerations when approaching investments kind of in this region?
Yeah, for sure. It's interesting. And I think the perception of emerging markets is very dynamic and changing. So to date, our Valhalla's investment practice has been pretty geography agnostic, although I would say if you look at our allocation patterns, they probably fairly closely mirror those of, you know, traditional VC markets. So Silicon Valley, New York, LA, et cetera, are where the preponderance of our portfolio companies are based. That said, we have invested in some off the beaten path areas, probably one of the most notable being Bugatti Rimac, which I mentioned prior. So during the pandemic, I actually was traveling in Croatia and met with Matej Rimac, who's the founder and CEO of Rimac Automobili. Rimac Automobili was started in Zagreb. And basically, Matej had started tuning old BMWs and then converting them into all-electric, essentially supercars. He started beating internal combustion engine cars and started catching the attention of you know, folks everywhere from Porsche to other hypercar manufacturers like Koenigsegg and others. And so I, during the pandemic, when I was traveling around Europe, the only country that would allow US passports in was actually Croatia. And so in order to get to other places in the EU that I wanted to travel, I just stopped through. And so while I was there, I figured, hey, I've heard of this company, Rimac. I should try to meet with the founder. So I reached out to some folks on LinkedIn. They actually set up a meeting between me and Matej. And at the time, you know, Matej was asking for help raising a $100 million Series C financing. We loved the opportunity. I saw, you know, the factory floor and walked in with Matej and saw that he had personally developed some 2,000 components for the cars, which is really impressive because most supercar or hypercar startups essentially just take parts from OEMs and then, you know, repackage them. But he had actually developed almost every single component in the Rimac Concept One and then the Rimac Nevera from scratch. And so that was super impressive. And then we pitched the deal to over 100 of our limited partners. We got 100 passes because folks really couldn't wrap their heads around why we saw value in an EV manufacturer based in Croatia. And what was frustrating was at the time, we knew that the company was in advanced conversations with Volkswagen to acquire Bugatti, but we couldn't share that with any of our investors because of the sensitive nature of the transaction. So essentially, a year later, the Bugatti acquisition became public. All of these, you know, media outlets were singing the rags to riches story of Matej Rimac and how he rose from this unknown tuner of BMWs to upset, you know, the most celebrated hypercar brands in the world, including Bugatti, Koenigsegg, others. And so a year later, we were able to raise a 20 million euro investment in their Series D at 3x the valuation of the Series C. But, you know, people got it at that point. And I think we're in an interesting time right now where people are going to see similar stories across other geographies. I think, you know, in particular, we're going to see similar stories across Central and Eastern Europe. There's just phenomenal engineering talent and the huge exodus of talent from Ukraine in light of the war there. I think is we're going to see a lot more innovative both hardware and software startups coming from Central and Eastern Europe. I'm also really bullish on Middle East and Africa, particularly in the GCC. You basically have, you know, the UAE, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Bahrain, Kuwait, et cetera. All of these countries are now essentially competing to attract innovation to their countries. And, you know, for example, in UAE, they did Hub 71, which is a blockchain accelerator with $2 billion in funding from the government. And similarly, you know, you've got the Abu Dhabi Investment Office and other sovereign wealth funds, et cetera, that are now setting up programs where essentially they're trying to attract Silicon Valley entrepreneurs and giving them free OPEX. So free office space, free lab space, you know, offering to subsidize employees, et cetera. And I think that's going to attract and already is starting to attract a lot of talent to the region. The other area that I see personally a lot of opportunity in is Southeast Asia. I think that there's an increasing number of resources companies. You see, Indonesia with their large nickel reserves attracting investment from a number of electric vehicle companies. I think also, as consumer markets, a lot of these are overlooked. And, for example, Thailand is now one of the larger EV markets and is actually one of the top EV markets for Porsche. In terms of sales, Tesla recently opened sales of EVs in Thailand as well and has seen very brisk sales. And there's a large expat population in Thailand. I've actually spent a significant amount of the past year in Thailand. I think there's an increasing amount, and the new government under Shretta, the new prime minister, is very aggressively going out and seeking deals with large tech companies like Microsoft, Nvidia, others, in order to try to attract more manufacturing and more jobs to Thailand. And I think that's also, dovetails with the increasing consumer market there. So I think, there's huge potential in these markets. To date, it's been a relatively small percentage of the overall time that we've been investing as Valhalla, but I think we definitely see a path for them to becoming a more significant focus area for us.
And Matt, to wrap up our call with our last question for the day, as a venture capitalist, how do you balance the need for short-term returns with the long-term vision required for successful investments? It's not always easy.
Yeah, venture is tricky in that regard. I think Naval put it best when he said, you have to play long-term games with long-term people. Of course, our goal as investors is to return capital to our limited partners as quickly as possible and at as high a multiple as possible, while hopefully simultaneously optimizing for social benefit and minimizing externalities. I think that's an overlooked part of the investment practice. But that said, early stage investing is kind of its own beast. Most companies that receive seed investments usually take about 2 to 3 years in order to find their first semblance of product market fit. So at this stage, when we're predominantly investing in seed stage companies. And so we're mostly betting on teams. And oftentimes it's not really clear at the time of the investment if there are going to be any exogenous factors, for example, a pandemic or a war or, things that will catalyze the growth trajectory of a given company. So it's, as one of our investors used to say, I have my crystal ball, but unfortunately it's broken. So it can be very tricky and unclear at the time of the investment whether or not there's going to be a tailwind that helps the company become a massive success. I think we're primarily focused on supporting really ambitious founders that have huge visions and also a correspondingly huge capability to execute. So we evaluate individuals based on track record, their pedigree, what they've done prior, and also just a gut instinct in terms of who really wants to win and who's got the capability, the know-how, the team, et cetera, in order to do that. So when we get conviction in a founder, it's because we see a path to them producing 100x or higher multiple in a period of about 7 to 10 years. That's about how long it takes for a seed investment to get liquid, either through an M&A transaction or an IPO. And so there, in terms of producing shorter term returns, there are mechanisms to do that, primarily through secondary sales, which have become, there are a number of platforms from Carta X and others that are now, facilitating secondary sales. And so there's a lot more, potential for a seed investor to get out at Series B or Series C, and we'll do that if we believe that the majority of the value inflection of a portfolio company has already been realized. But we tend to be more like more traditional VC investors, where our goal is, if we really believe in a founder or a company, that we want to hold an investment all the way through to a liquidity event. And so that usually is more of a 7 to a 10 year horizon. The good thing for early stage VCs is that if you can show a consistent track record of companies that you invest in getting marked up, and those companies, generating strong revenues, finding product market fit, developing key, breakthroughs and innovations, et cetera, is that then it becomes easier to raise follow-on funds. So our goal right now is really to allocate our fund one, which we just closed. That's a $66 million fund. Our goal is to allocate that in a way such that hopefully, out of a few dozen bets that we'll make, anywhere from 30 to 40 portfolio companies, about $1 million to $2 million per investment. Our goal is that enough of those companies will start to find product market fit and start to have that breakout success, raise follow-on Series A financings at higher valuations, et cetera, over the next couple of years, that, kind of end of 2024, beginning of 2025, we'll be able to go back to market and say, hey, we raised this first fund, we invested it intelligently, the companies that we invested in are on their way to success. And have received enough markups in order to justify us going out and raising a second fund. So that's really our primary focus right now. And are very fortunate to have an LP base that is very patient. I think it's interesting in the deep tech space, you're actually seeing a couple of funds. There are funds like Prime Impact and a number of others that actually said, hey guys, the development cycles in deep tech are actually much longer, and so we're actually going to extend our fund terms to actually, 15-year funds. Traditionally most funds are 10-year funds, and now we're seeing more deep tech funds, particularly working with philanthropic sources of capital. So either, either foundations, also some that are working with like endowments, pension funds, like sovereign wealth funds, like very large pools of capital that can afford to wait a bit longer in order to get returns. So I think that's also becoming more of a trend. I don't know that we're going to go for that in the short term. I think we're going to wait to see how quickly we can get liquidity on some of these deep tech investments. But that's something that we would obviously consider if we see a substantial benefit for our LPs. But of course, first and foremost, focused on investing in great companies, seeing them through to acquisition or IPO, and hopefully doing that sooner rather than later.
Matt, for people out there who are interested in catching a cup of coffee with you or connecting with you for a chat, what would be the best point of contact?
Folks can reach out to me easily via email. You can send a note to MK, as in Matthew King, at Valhalla.ventures. So MK at Valhalla.ventures. And then you can also just, we have a contact on our website, Valhalla.ventures. And that goes to Rohan, who is our partner who leads our deep tech practice. He also is closest to diligencing companies, et cetera. So that's also a great first point of contact. His email also is just ro at Valhalla.ventures. And then for gaming founders, please reach out to Davin. His email is Dave, DEV, at Valhalla.ventures.
Matt, it was a pleasure having you on Geeks of the Valley, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, of course. Kunal, thank you for having me. It was such a pleasure, and really thrilled and honored to join the incredible list of guests that you've had prior. So thanks for giving me the opportunity, and look forward to the next one.
Thank you.